The Front Page's end of year review show will look at Oisin Murphy, Willie Mullins' massive price winner successfully axing the racing tax and asking what was the best race run in 2025. All that and so much more on this week's edition of The Front Page. Hello everyone and welcome to this special edition of The Front Page, in which we are looking back at the year almost now just gone, 2025. I am Lee Mottershead and I'm joined by my Racing Post colleagues Chris Cook and Jonathan Harding. Hello men.
Hiya.
Enjoyed the year?
Love the year. Yeah, lots to go at.
Yeah. Chris, happy?
Oh,
well.
Yeah. Always.
Still here. Can't say fairer than that, really. No, it's been plenty to talk about, right, on the racing front. And as a journalist, that's what you want. Masses of controversy and concern and winners where you're left going, how did that happen? So
yeah, a lot
fun.
Of that. Definitely. Well, Chris, as he's still here, Kempton is still here. But for how much longer? Because that became one of the big stories of December, and now it's going to be one of the big stories of 2025, could be one of the big stories of 2026. We discovered earlier this year that an option agreement was taken out between the Jockey Club and housing developer Redrow in 2018, which commits the Jockey Club, in theory, to selling Kempton to Redrow should certain criteria be met and Redrow achieves planning permission. That was that became a story again towards the end of the year when the Jockey Club's new chief executive, Jim Mullen, who was appointed this year, gave a series of media interviews in December talking about his plans and ambitions for the Jockey Club in 2026 and beyond. He was asked by our colleague Bill Barber about Kempton, and he said in that interview that Kempton's future was out of my hands, highlighting that control of the Jockey Club series seemingly had passed to Redrow. We will find out in 2026 if Redrow takes up that option. It might well be motivated to do so by the passing of a piece of legislation through Parliament this year, which gives the government more power in relation to housing developments and forcing through planning approval. We were all back at Kempton, many of us were, over Christmas for two great days of racing, where attendances saw 23% attendance increase at Kempton, and they staged one of the great races of the year, one of the great races full stop, a King George VI chase in which four horses jumped the final fence together and the Jukebox Man went on to win by two noses and a half length. It was, Chris, an amazing race, and talk about timely.
Yeah, I'm sort of hoping that all of that fankle about, yeah, we've done the deal, actually, we've sold the place to these developers, is just a really cunning way of driving up ticket sales. I mean, as you pointed out, attendance over those 2 days gone up 23%. Maybe other courses should be trying this. You know, the management down at Taunton saying, well, yeah, if you don't come this weekend, we're going to sell it. You know, it's good housing land, you know, use it or lose it. It's just, it's a bit hard to believe, isn't it? That, you know, after that enormous pushback we remember from, was it 2017, when they first sent out that press release saying, by the way, we're going to invest heavily at Newmarket and we're going to sell Kempton. We let them know across the sport that that just wasn't an acceptable way to go. And now to be told the year after that, they went ahead and signed a deal which they've managed to keep secret for 7 years. You know, it's hard to take in. I would like to know more details, perhaps even see some documentary evidence. You know, are there terms and conditions? Are there, you know, does it have to be a sale of the entire site? Can't they just build around the fringes like at Newbury, where, you know, you get a flow of money coming into the place, plus you've got people living there who are going to be annual members, hopefully. It seems to work pretty well for Newbury. Why couldn't that work for Kempton as well? It's a desperate situation to think that we might be losing that track that has been so often a source of, you know, really good quality King George's, and a race that is also distinctly different from the Gold Cup.
Yeah,
you know, you know what a Kempton type of champion is, a sort of a wayward lad, versus the kind of horse that wins at Cheltenham. I can imagine a King George being run at Ascot being a success in terms of the crowd that you could get through the gate, but if you run the King George at Ascot, you're going to get a different kind of horse winning. Wayward Lad might never have won the race round there. Plus, it's really difficult to move the race there considering it's owned by the Jockey Club.
Yeah, John, in terms of the King George itself then? And if we were in a world where Kempton didn't exist, and there has to be a fair chance of that given the way things have progressed, there's been talk about where the King George would go to. Suggestion that Aintree might be the Jockey Club's favoured option. But that idea has surely been kiboshed by what happened on Boxing Day, when yet again the low sun became an issue at Aintree, and there was a 3 mile steeplechase 15 minutes before the King George in which 9 of the intended 19 fences weren't jumped because of low sun. So you surely can't move the King George there knowing that that could be an issue. In 2017, Sandown was named as the next destination of the King George. There doesn't appear to be much appetite for that at the moment. We know Sandown in the winter can be horribly deep ground, very different to Kempton. And we also know from what Jim Mullen said in December, this month, that the Jockey Club's intentions were to invest most heavily in its two most profitable tracks, Cheltenham and Aintree. And there was no reference to Sandown receiving the big chunk of investment that had been promised in 2017 when it was named as the next King George destination. I wrote a piece at Ascot over Christmas suggesting, could the idea of Ascot taking the King George occur at some point in the future? That would require a commercial transaction between the Jockey Club and Ascot. But we know that in this year, the Criterion Stakes that used to be run at Newmarket was run at York for the first time this year because of a commercial deal between the Jockey Club and York. So if we lose Kempton, we need to have a new home for the King George. The new home for a race that we saw this year is perfectly suited to the venue where it has traditionally been staged, because you would not have had a King George like that where the Jukebox Man, Banbridge, Django Bay and Gaelic Warrior Jump the Final Fence together anywhere else.
Yeah, because there would have been no fences in the straight. Aintree, it would have just been a flat race as soon as they turned for home.
Yeah,
I mean, Aintree is... I think that's where your mind goes to first, because it's obviously invested in this Boxing Day meeting. It's got, it has the event you could tie it around, but low sun is an issue. Sandown just feels wrong to me. I know that was the one that was floated originally, but it's just a completely different test. I just can't have that at all. Ascot, like you, is where you're thinking, okay, I can see that. It could take that sort of crowd. It is the sort of track that you'd want a marquee event, because that's, you know, let's have it right. The King George is... outside of the National, outside of Cheltenham, that is one of the biggest jumps races. And I don't think it perhaps gets the respect it deserves sometimes as one of the sport's crown jewels. I think it's, you need to look at the atmosphere and the crowd that you got this month to understand how much it still means. I don't have an answer to your question, ultimately. I think ideally you just run it at Kempton because that's where the King George should be run. Well, I don't see, and I don't see there isn't a good alternative. There's not a perfect alternative.
I think there are questions, though, that do need answered. Chris, you referenced one of them, the fact that there's a 7-year gap between the Jockey Club doing this deal with Redrow and the emerging this year that the deal existed. I referenced in a piece from Kempton on Saturday, I had a brief word with Jockey Club senior steward Dido Harding, because Dido Harding was on the board of stewards in 2018 when this Redrow deal was done. She's obviously now the senior steward. There has to be a sense of accountability from the Jockey Club. That line from Jim Mullen, "It's out of my hands," almost implied, perhaps unintentionally, that this wasn't our thing anymore. We can't, you know, we can't be involved in this now. We can't determine Kempton's future. That is maybe questionable, but certainly someone has to explain why the Jockey Club did a deal that puts itself in this situation.
Yeah, well, 100%. The Jockey Club gets quite a lot of good PR from this idea that it exists only to benefit the sport of racing. That is completely at odds with what's been going on over Kempton, if you take their word for what's happened. I mean, I think there's, like you said, there's still questions to be answered about what exactly has been agreed. You know, is there any wiggle room? There must be. You know, a deal from 2018 surely doesn't bind the Jockey Club leadership now if it doesn't want to sort of go along the same lines as what was being talked about then. You know, that would be a crazy situation to be in. So, I mean, I think it's right that the Jockey Club now has to be held accountable for whatever happens. And in the meantime, maybe we shouldn't be, you know, too pessimistic. I know there's lots of people out there sort of feeling basically that they've seen the last King George at Kempton. It doesn't have to be that way. You know, there's nothing imminent that we think you know, in terms of, you know, any deal being done, Redder have gone very quiet. We can hope for the best. We can hope for another 60 years of jump racing at Kempton.
Has that been the case in 2030? Will Kempton still exist as a racecourse?
Oh, I hope so. I don't see any reason why not. And if it doesn't, then, you know, I want to see certain people being held to account for that. Because, you know, it would be a disgraceful situation to be in. One, you know, a course that contributes so much to the sport and is so much a part of our heritage should be lost. When it 100% should still be functioning as a profitable track.
There's a lack of transparency, isn't it? That's what's left a sour taste. You know, to have this sort of sprung and say, well, it's out of our hands, sorry, is such a... It forgets the fact of, oh, how do we get here? Why are we in a situation where it's out of the jockey club's hands? That's just completely, that's not acceptable. You need to explain in great detail how we've reached this position.
Why are we just being told no?
Exactly. If they can, because, you know, as journalists, there's a natural cynicism. The fact that we're being told now, the brain naturally goes to, well, they're saying this for a reason. They're sort of setting us up. They're preparing us for something that they might know is coming down the line. That's the logical step. And that's, I think, why it has created so much concern, because of the timing of it. And that lends a certain urgency to it. If you're thinking, they've told us now, there must be more bad news coming and they're softening us up for it.
And the irony as well is that it came almost right on hot on the heels of an announcement, which we'll talk about later on, about the Derby at Epsom, where there's going to be lots of investment in Epsom.
Yeah.
They also announced, Jim Mullen also was unequivocally saying, we don't plan to close any racecourses. I think you put Kempton to one side on that one. So there was a degree of positivity about what he was saying.
Yeah,
that was completely washed away by this news about Kempton.
I think if you're open and you have the discussion and say, you know, Kempton's been a hard racecourse to fill. It doesn't get the crowds outside of King George. There are challenges there.
But it is very profitable.
Yeah. And if they say, we have to make a commercial decision because of X, Y, and Z, okay, we can have that conversation. It's just having it sprung on you and this apparent secrecy around it that I just can't stomach myself.
I mean, and the point you made, all those desires for investment at various other tracks, just goes to show that they do have a pressing need for, you know, a large sum of money. Where are they going to get that, you know, in a situation where the Cheltenham Festival isn't drawing as many people as it used to?
Yeah.
This would be a quick way to raise a mega sum, and it would be hard for them to identify, I suppose, any alternative way of generating anything comparable in terms of the amount of money they would get for building on Kempton. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it's a good idea. We would much rather, as a sport, that they did the hard yards and found other ways of making the sums add up.
Yeah, absolutely. Our second story relates to a horse who we would have been expecting to see at Kempton on Boxing Day, Constitution Hill. And his fall from grace, and indeed his falls everywhere this season, are a big story, because Constitution Hill was just about the highest profile horse in training, certainly the highest profile jumps horse in training. His year started in January at Cheltenham when he won the international hurdle there, almost falling at the final flight. And that gave us a taste of, sadly, what was to come, because in a drama-laden champion hurdle, he fell for the first time in his life. We know that thereafter, State Man fell at the final flight, gifting the race to Golden Ace. Constitution Hill then went on to Aintree, where he fell at the second last flight of the Aintree hurdle. He then went to Punchestown and got round in their champion hurdle, albeit ran desperately disappointingly. Work was done on the horse during the summer and autumn in a bid to revive his career. We went off to Newcastle for a fighting for hurdle that was eagerly anticipated, and again he fell, this time at the second flight, and again the fall was almost a carbon copy of those that had taken place at Cheltenham and Aintree. So now, John, we're in a situation where we don't really know what's going to happen with Constitution Hill's career. Nicky Henderson was talking at Kempton after Sergino's winning the Christmas hurdle and saying that all options still seemingly remain open with Constitution Hill. But that fall from grace, the extent to which his career changed completely, is remarkable.
Yeah, it's been remarkable. It's been a roller coaster to cover. It's like the Bermuda Triangle in terms of mysteries, because I cannot put my finger, and seemingly neither can Nicky Henderson and Michael Buckley and Nico de Boinville, cannot put my finger on why he's gone from being you know, one of the finest jumpers of a hurdler I'd seen in a long time, to just it not working. Is it the design of the hurdles? I've seen other people say he might benefit from maybe a more forceful jockey. Maybe it could just be a psychological thing that he doesn't want to do it anymore. I think Punchestown was the most concerning for me because he just, right. he was sending out warning signals very early that he's just, maybe there is some psychological damage there. There is an element of, look, I just don't fancy this. I think maybe those falls were heavier than we thought originally. You have a couple of falls through bad luck and suddenly that's a lot for a horse to get over. The best ones are usually the most intelligent as well. I don't know if that's a sort of old wives' tale, but it feels that way, that, you know, he's so close and he always was just on the edge, and that's what made him brilliant, and that's what now is making him so vulnerable.
And the way he sort of flung himself at that second hurdle at Newcastle really looked a lot like a horse who just, he was panicking, wasn't he? He was like, what on earth do I do? I don't want to get this wrong. Oh God, I have. Up to that point, I was sort of prepared to believe that, you know, he'd been maybe a little bit unlucky at Cheltenham, and then, you know, Aintree had come soon afterwards, and you punch us down. Like with a lot of horses, you could put a line through it, it's end of season stuff. You know, I was prepared to imagine that he could have a successful comeback at Newcastle and it would all be forgotten. But he did that. And now it looks a lot like he's got a real issue in his head and they don't know how to fix it. I don't feel like I want to see him running over hurdles again because, you know, how could you bear it?
Well, how could you bear it? How could the sport bear it? Because without wishing to be doom-laden, if, God forbid, anything happened to Constitution Hill in a race over jumps...
Doesn't bear thinking about.
No, I mean, as well as the tragedy of what happened to the horse, the sport would be beset by negative headlines, and you could argue deservedly so. But
anyone outside the sport who's got any kind of suspicion about jump racing would be pointing at us and going, you were well warned about this with this horse. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world to see coming. It is sad that it's gone this way. But, you know, I think it's time for discretion to be the better part of valor, right? I mean, they still talk about how he's a fast horse. Of course he should be. You can run him on the flat. It'd be very interesting to see what would happen there. But as for jumping things, I think, you know, unfortunately, it might be time to draw a line.
I think so. But, Johnny, again, Nicky was saying at Kempton, you know, lots of options for him, and we're not ruling anything out. But if they were to go on the flat, it would be a fascinating development because, you know, one of Nick Henson's jokes always been with this horse, you know, he could win a July Cup, which I think he said with a few horses, or a King's Stand Stakes, rather. That was line, wasn't it? But, you know, he potentially could be very good in the flat. They did enter him, didn't they, for the Gold Cup at Ascot this year initially, didn't go through with it.
Gave me a very busy morning, if I remember.
Okay, you were involved in that
entries,
one. Yeah. But it would be a fascinating addition.
I'd love to see it. Yeah, and look at Ethical Diamond, we'll get onto that, and William Mullins, why not? And it would be good to see him enjoying himself. He might not love it on the flat, you might think we're going far too quickly here, but I think that would be, as a story, fantastic. They've ruled out chasing, it seems. That's sort of the very traditionalist view of, well, you know, he'd respect a fence. I think he'd get himself into all sorts of trouble over a fence with his style of jumping. There's a reason they didn't go chasing with him before. I don't see a reason to now. I'm slightly torn on the hurdles. I think I'm a bit like you. I'd be watching it from behind the sofa. I think if you're going to do it, would they maybe not do it in Britain? They do it, get him to jump a hurdle in Ireland, maybe jump in France.
Just talk about the white panels.
Yeah, I don't feel qualified to.
No, me neither.
You know, I don't know. Maybe there is something in that. We're all guessing, aren't we?
All the other horses are also jumping the white hurdles, aren't they? And this, you know, we're not seeing widespread problems, are we?
No. Could Nicky Henderson though still win the champion hurdle? I mean, Sir Gino has now been brought into the champion hurdle picture. He was meant to be going over fences. He's now gone over hurdles. He won the Christmas hurdle easily. Just quickly, guys, does he win the champion hurdle?
Yeah, he obviously could.
There's a ringing endorsement.
Well, it's happened, hasn't it? Horses coming back from chasing to win champion hurdles. I tend to think a specialist hurdler is going to be where my money's going in March. But, you know, that doesn't determine anything, unfortunately.
He does jump hurdles like fences, John.
Yeah, I'm willing to get overexcited. Let's overhype a horse. It's that time of year.
Well, he's not going to do that, is he? So
I'll hype a horse. No, I think he's the most exciting horse in training over jumps currently.
Okay.
Is my big shout. Certainly in Britain, and I think he'd win a champion hurdle or he'd win over fences at the Cheltenham Festival. I think he might be that good.
We're giving hostages to fortune because there's a really big 2 mile hurdle going to be run this afternoon in Ireland. You know, might be an idea to watch that before we start spraying money around in the champion hurdle market.
Yes, viewers, we are recording this on the morning of, is it December 29th?
Yes.
It's Monday. It's basically Monday morning, and there is a big hurdle race at Leopardstown taking place soon afterwards, which Willie Mullins, by the time you watch this, may have won or may not have won. But he did do a lot of winning in 2025.
What a link.
Thank you. Just that by accident, this. John referenced Ethical Diamond in the Breeders' Cup Turf, which was just wacky. And it ended an extraordinary year for an extraordinary man who, again, dominated jump racing in Britain and Ireland. He was champion trainer of Ireland for the zillionth time. He defended his British Trainers Championship, helped by winning the Grand National and by finishing second and third in the Grand National.
The Grand National winner and seventh.
The Grand National winner was ridden by his son, Racing Post journalist Patrick Mullins. And then, to top it all, a guy who basically most people in American racing had never heard of went and trained the Breeders' Cup Turf winner. He won it with a horse who broke the course record and had been beaten heavily in the Scottish Champion Hurdle back in April. Chris, go figure.
Yeah, an amazing year. That's without mentioning Pony Ross winning the Triumph Hurdle.
100-1.
Having
first one
never
ever
jumped a hurdle.
Just pulled out the field.
There was that great quote. I think it might be my favourite quote of the year, actually, where Willie was talking afterwards about the horse's preparation, and he said they sort of looked at each other about sort of late January time and said, why don't we bring him in for the field and get him ready for Cheltenham? We need to be talking to him about the same time this year.
Although this time the horse will have had to run over hurdles.
But still.
They changed the rules after Willie Mullins win.
What are you dragging in from a field in January? That's going to be a key question, I think. Yeah. It's interesting because you think of him as having all the hot pots for all these major races, as of course he does, but quite often the one that wins, you know, can be second, third, fourth string, maybe often is overcooking it, but it can happen. Lucky Watson was another on the Brown Advisory at 20-1. Oddly, if you're a value seeker at the major jump racing meetings, I think quite a good way to go to try and get an outsider winner is one of Willie's other ones, because the market just goes heavily in favour of the perceived first string. Whatever Paul Town ends on, you know, that's going to be a short price. And the others tend to get ignored. That being said, you know, you could show me the Pony Ross Triumph Hurdle again and I still wouldn't even think about backing a hurdling debutant in a race like that. It's extraordinary that happened. And was it Lalamba that nicked second?
Anyone that backed that
one must, you know, you've been struck by lightning, basically.
I was struck by lightning.
Yeah. And not for the first time.
No, happens frequently. John, the fact that he then went and won the Grand National, and as Chris said, finished second, third, was it fifth and seventh?
Yeah.
So completely dominated the Grand National. They went to the final fence, it was basically just Willie Mullins trained horses dominating that finish. But winning it with Patrick, his response to that, I mean, he was, I remember sticking a dictaphone under his nose, as Matt Chapman put a microphone under his nose. He was genuinely emotional. The voice was breaking. You sort of forget sometimes that these people that win everything, they can still be really struck by something. And if you're going to struck by anything, winning the world's greatest horse race with your boy in the saddle was a hell of a thing.
Yeah, it was quite something. And I was on that report, and you know what it's like, where you're just there and you're caught up in the occasion. You think, God, I hope the quotes do this justice. Mm. And it was actually the lack of quotes that did it justice, because he was, as you say, he was visibly moved. And we, through our coverage and through just his sheer efficiency at winning at the highest level, you almost expect him to be a Terminator-esque, well, this is just another day at the office. You know, the postman doesn't celebrate when he delivers letters, that sort of vibe. But actually, it was really endearing to see that these races do mean an awful lot to him still. That's not supposed to happen, by the way. That's the bit we forget. You're not supposed to, the Grand National is not supposed to be a race that you can have that many in the top five, top seven. I mean, it probably speaks to the nature of the race now, which is an entirely different, it's a whole show in itself. But it's just a remarkable achievement. And then you add a Breeders' Cup. I wonder what he was doing, not winning a Melbourne Cup. I feel like he needs to up his game.
That is the one he still does have to do. And he was out, so I was out in Melbourne. He came in from California, where he hadn't drunk a lot of water.
Still celebrating.
Yeah, hadn't drunk a lot of water. He made that point himself. But he still wants to win a Melbourne Cup. He hasn't done it yet. Absurd ran okay. But he will win a Melbourne Cup. And Chris, to win a
Steady on, that's a hard race to be giving away to anyone.
Yeah, but I would be surprised if he doesn't do, just because he wants to do it so much. But to win, I mean, if anyone had said in the moments after the Ebor that Ethical Diamond, who was, say, was beaten in the county hurdle and the Scottish champion hurdle, would go on to even run in the Breeders' Cup turf, let alone hose up in the Breeders' Cup turf, they'd have said you were completely balmy.
I think that's fair, and but that gives you a sense of, you know, magic, right? The magic that can happen when you've got a really genius trainer. Listening to the people around him as well, I suppose it was David Casey's idea, wasn't it, to make the entry for the Breeders' Cup turf and to go for it, and Willie had to be talked into it. But, you know, he's preparing these horses, he's bringing them into the operation in the first place. There's probably a lot of people who deserve credit when these things come off. They've just got a really effective operation going there, which begins by absorbing an awful lot of talented, you know, promising young horse flesh. It's hard to win if you're anywhere else, and you know, the downside to having, you know, four such mega operations in Ireland is that they're sort of losing the plurality a bit, aren't they? You know, other trainers are being put under enormous pressure because the big operations hoover up so much prize money. So you can't have it all ways. You know, personally, and I've said this before, I would much rather have a more even spread of the equine talent in Ireland and in Britain.
And you would try to actually physically intervene to make that happen?
Well, I think, you know, you have to do something. Our rulers are doing nothing. You know, what we have in racing just now is a completely laissez-faire policy. Do what you like. And it used to work. You know, back in the 80s and 90s when I was getting into the sport, owners would send horses to their local trainer. Yeah. And you can't rely on that now. Everybody wants to be with the big names. And so what you're getting is sort of fewer and fewer trainers who are able to compete in the best races.
As we end the year, John, there is just a slight change in the sense that Willie Mullins here and now isn't as dominant as he was at any other point during the year. Yeah. You look at the Christmas results. We're talking before the December hurdle at Leopardstown, so he might win that. But across the festival, generally speaking, Ballyburn was disappointing. He didn't win the Savills Chase, so having tons of runners in the race. Across Christmas as a whole, he's had loads of winners, but he hasn't quite been as dominant as he normally is. Now, you'd imagine that normal service will resume at some point soon, but so far in Ireland, it's been Gordon Elliott's year more than Willie Mullins.
Yeah, and I was wondering on the way in how much of that is Willie Mullins maybe not in the same level of form, and how much of that is Gordon Elliott's just quietly been rebuilding and is getting somewhere towards the peak of his powers, because, you know, we know he can train very well when he gets the right horses. It wasn't that long ago I was interviewing him as leading trainer at Cheltenham a few times.
Yeah.
It was only a matter of time before he got back to, I mean, he has to fight at that sort of level to even compete with Willie Mullins. I don't know with that. It's a bit like, you know, teams winning multiple Premier Leagues, and then could this be just a slight drop off in terms of the quality in his yard, the quality of his team? I don't know. I doubt it. I think it's probably just...
He's all about the spring, isn't he, Willie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
I think there was a flavour of this last Christmas. You know, he did well, but maybe not quite as well as you might have thought for a juggernaut operation like his. I'd bet anything that come middle of March and then on to April, he's cleaning up again. It's really hard in a jump season to, as a trainer, to maintain your form all the way through, and he doesn't try to. You know, he's very much aiming at the end of it. So Gordon is kind of, to an extent, picking up the pieces by getting his lot in form in the autumn, and then he's done fantastically well. But if he can still be winning races in the middle of March, he's done an amazing thing. You see a little bit of the same, I think, with Gavin Cromwell. He was hot in October, then November just seemed to be a nightmare. I think he had 110 runners in Ireland and only one of them won.
And goodness, another way of thinking yesterday.
I mean, just ran no race at all.
Yeah.
So you sort of think there might have been something in the yard affecting them, and he's one that hasn't just bounced back from it yet. And the market seemed to anticipate that he was going to run poorly. So I think the most likely thing is that he does bounce back at some stage, maybe in time for the Irish Gold Cup. Probably, I would say, in time for the Gold Cup. It was weird to see two such, you know, depressing performances from a horse that was able to run to such a high standard in the Gold Cup. It's going to be a bit odd if he ends up continuing to be that kind of one performance a year type of horse. He really looked like a special talent the last spring. Mm. And I think we can legitimately hope to see a bit more from him in future seasons. But
yeah, I certainly wouldn't abandon all hope of it. I mean, he's still the favourite for the Gold Cup with a lot of bookmakers.
How could you back him even at 6 or 7 to 1? Mm. Even knowing that he's probably going to bounce back after two efforts like the ones he started this season with, you'd feel such a fool if you backed him at those odds now and then he runs poorly again in March. You'd think, well, I really ought to have seen that coming, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interest from punters in horses at other prices. Haiti Couleurs is being talked up a lot, after that amazing performance at Chepstow. But I just worry slightly that, if last year's winner bounces back, or last season's winner bounces back, all of that money is going to get raked in by the bookies.
Well, just quickly, before we move on to the next story, I say the Jukebox Man wins the Gold Cup. You say?
Affordale Fury.
Oh, okay.
I'm quite excited by that performance.
Okay, good.
I guess sticking with no-mead horses at Cheltenham hasn't historically been a brilliant way to go, but you'd love to see it, right?
Yeah, you would. John?
I will stick with the horse I backed a few months ago after Cheltenham, Haiti Couleurs.
Haiti Couleurs, great winner of the Welsh National on the 27th. Still to come, we will be talking about Frankie Dettori, about Rachel Blackmore, about Aisin Murphy, and about lots of horses winning lots of races at huge, huge odds. And talking about big numbers, there was much fear in British racing this year about the financial damage that would be done if Rachel Reeves amended the tax rates at which British racing costs to bookmakers. There was an Axe the Racing tax campaign amid fears that the Treasury would harmonise racing's tax level with those of gaming and general sports. In the end, it didn't happen. There was a strike in British racing for the first time on September 10th. It wasn't called a strike, but in effect it was a strike. The race meetings which take place that day did not take place. And when the budget came along, Rachel Reeves decided in the end to make a special case for horse racing. The remote gaming tax rate soared from 21% to 40%. There was a change to the general betting duty rate for sports betting, but racing was untouched. There might still, though, be major shrapnel damage for British racing if bookmakers react to the tax hike they have received. They almost certainly will. Looking after that, dealing with that, as the head honcho in British racing, will be Lord Charles Allen, the commercial heavyweight who finally came in as the sports BHA chair in the autumn, having dillied and dallied about whether to take the job. In the end, he did take the job, and he promised to make significant changes in the new year, including with a new independent board for the BHA. John, it was a big year on the racing politics front.
Certainly was, yeah. It kept us busy, didn't it?
Yep.
Racing tax in particular, as it's been dubbed. I'm still a little bit torn about that whole situation, which might be accused of being sat on the fence, but I can sort of see both sides on this one. I can understand the bookmakers' frustration at what they perceive to be a celebration by racing, saying, well, look, we're getting hit over here, so you will feel the consequences of this. Put the party poppers away. This isn't actually good news. I could understand that. I could understand their frustration with some people in racing who I think were very keen to say, we're not like casino games, quite rightly, but then maybe took it a step further and said, tax them all you want, we're not bothered. At the same time, I can see racing's position and, well, it's not our job to go into bat for the whole gambling industry, and we had to fight our corner. And the sense is that they did that very effectively. I think that campaign was heard. Well, I know from conversations with politicians and people close to them that the Axe the Racing Tax campaign did make a splash. You'd imagine it did influence what was essentially a carve-out. It's just one of those where I hope that the lesson from this is that need to have a more productive relationship between the two industries. I hope some sensible people in racing and sensible people in the gambling industry are now able to get together and kind of chart a more beneficial course, because it is symbiotic, and I think they maybe did become slightly at loggerheads, and there was a lot of words thrown around in the aftermath of the autumn budget. So I hope that that's where we get to.
Yeah, and I think Chris, the loggerheads that John refers to a large extent dates back to that period before Rishi Sunak called the last UK general election, when there was an attempt to secure a significant levy reform deal. It didn't happen because the election was called. Racing said that a deal was on the table when Sunak called the election. Bookmakers said a deal hadn't been agreed, so the two parties disagreed there. They certainly didn't work together in this Axe the Racing Tax campaign. As John says, it's led to bitterness on the part of bookmakers. Charles Allen, the new BHA chair, is saying that there needs to be a much more harmonious, effective working relationship between the two.
It's easily said, isn't it?
It's been said so many, and that the danger is so much of what Charles Allen is saying in terms of what he wants are things that have been said before. We've not yet heard how he's really going to affect major change in the sport.
There's probably a limit to what you can say in public. Yeah. You'd like to imagine that, you know, behind the scenes they're playing 4D chess, you know, they've got it all worked out, right?
And he's played behind the scenes extremely well so far in terms of securing what he wanted in terms of governance reform. That was all done behind the scenes. So maybe that is just his modus operandi.
You can easily believe that. And so there's reason for hope, right? But, you know, there's been an awful lot of bridge burning between racing and the bookies. Over the last 18 months, you know, there's this perception from the bookies side that some people in racing have been, you know, trying to do deals with anti-gambling campaigners in order to make themselves appear, you know, the sport appear more presentable to government. I can't remember more anger and dislike, you know, between racing and betting than there has been recently. And God knows there's been a lot of tension over the years, but it really reached a peak in the last 2 or 3 months. And we haven't heard details of bits of fallout from the budget, like, you know, who's going to close how many shops. It feels like, you know, there's going to be some announcements in the new year, which will make for dismal reading. Things have got to get better. Hopefully there's some clever people on the case. But money's too tight to mention. It's a very worrying time.
It is a worrying time. And John, how painful will the damage be to racing, do you think? It's very hard to be definitive about it, because we don't know how bookmakers will react. But do you think it will be as bad as bookmakers have predicted it will be?
I think when the dust settles, no. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the real giant ones, they are now global operations. You know, they're taking a hit here, but they're also making a lot of money elsewhere. I think it would just be a consolidation. There definitely is going to be a hit, but whether it's as bad as people are predicting, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because racing, if you are in the boardroom of Flutter or wherever, and you're looking at the entire thing, and you're looking at racing is a very expensive product to them, and if it no longer makes financial sense, for all the sentiment, for all the fact they like the history, they want to invest in racing, there's a lot of racing fans working for these companies, if the numbers don't add up, they don't add up. So that's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah. And I guess, Chris, the big worry is that it's going to be customers, punters, who potentially will suffer the most, both from more restrictions, from worse prices, from worse offers. And we know how much of an excess has been to the black market, the gambling black market. Now, you can argue that, and I have argued, that bookmakers have been doing that willfully unknowingly already through restrictions, but there's a danger that punters and customers will be hit by all this.
Well, the bookies have made that point over and over, that the ultimate losers will be the punters. Hopefully they can find ways to mitigate that to some extent, because, you know, those are their customers and they need them to
still be interested in betting generally and on horses in particular. It's been a very successful business for bookies for a very long time. The worry, I think, for me is that there's going to be a cumulative effect, because we've had years now of punters experiencing worse conditions than they had in the past, starting with the affordability checks and account closures and all of that. It's been going on for a long time, and the heyday of betting on horses, how far back would you have to go, 15 years more to find the point where it was at its best? And the further we get away from that, the more you're asking people to sort of really go against their own interests, if you like, in sticking with the sport, in tougher times. But it's a key part of racing's audience, people who want to bet on the game. That's a huge part of our attraction. We have to find ways of making that, more attractive in the future than it has been in the immediate past.
Next up then, we talked about earlier on about Constitution Hill's fall from grace. Well, Ashine Murphy has fallen from grace, but he's fallen from grace before. What happened this year in some ways wasn't a new narrative. In April, the champion jockey was involved in a single vehicle road incident in which he drove his car into a tree. It then emerged that he had been well over the legal alcohol limit for driving. In July, he was given a 20-month driving ban and a £70,000 fine. He returned, though, as good as ever. In fact, he never stopped riding. But not only did he come back, he came back in style. He retained his champion jockey title, won that for the fifth time. He had a host of major big race victories domestically and abroad. And seemingly career-wise, what happened didn't affect his career whatsoever. Chris, you've written a lot about Ashine over the years. Again, talk about a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, it's been crazy. But the most impressive thing about him, I think, is as a jockey, is his resilience. Five championships is a lot. It's more than anyone's won since Kieran Fallon days. Three titles has been about the standard for a really good jockey. That's Ryan Moore had three, Richard Hughes, Sylvester D'Souza. There have been a few others, I think, who sort of win three, and then it's like they want to focus on the big days and not do the grind that you have to do to get enough winners to be champion again. He's still young. He's still seemingly very willing to do those hard yards. And he's he wins a hell of a lot of races. He's very popular with owners and trainers.
And with a lot of racing fans too.
Yeah, and of course, anyone who rides that number of winners is going to be very popular with people who bet on racing. He's not the sort of charismatic young force that I think we sort of originally imagined and hoped he was going to be. We can remember days when he was sort of closer to the start of his career, when he'd be using social media to project his thoughts about the sport, going directly to fans of racing and coming across really well. These days, the Ashine we know is a sort of slightly more complex personality. Not so unequivocally a force for good in the game. Andrew Balding has said, we expect better in terms of his behaviour than what we saw this year. In terms of what you get when you put him on a horse, he's an amazing flat jockey. I just hope that he can deal with whatever he has to deal with privately and keep that career going, for as long as he can, because a big race without him is missing something.
Yeah, I mean, again, as Chris says, John, his riding this year was sublime. His ability to cope with pressure is extraordinary, because at Royal Ascot, not long after this all was blowing up, he was riding winners left, right and centre. And yet there are all the issues that go along with Ashine Murphy, say, referenced at the top of the piece. He's had other downfalls. There was the COVID breach. There have been occasions when he's tested positive for alcohol on race course and not been allowed to ride. there was that point when it looked as though he would be the guy who took over Franco De Tori and really sold the sport to the public. It's much harder to do that with someone with his backstory and with his ongoing issues. He's a very difficult person to know what to think about.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you can get caught in the long grass with it a little bit, but I think my main thought is he's just got far too much talent to waste. Mm. That's the main. I think everybody agrees that in the saddle there are few better, and it is frustrating. You sort of get the news alert and go, oh, really? You know, yeah. Why? Because you are such a fantastic athlete and an interesting person to talk to. It's probably a question for Ashin. I've always wondered with high performing athletes how much of the job is actually linked to the other stuff, whether it is the grind of it, whether it is the pressure of it, whether those two go hand in hand, you know, the slightly destructive behavior and the constant pursuit of winners and championships. Are they playing off against one another? Is one needed for the other? That is a question for him, but...
Well, it's not just him. There is quite a long established history, isn't there?
Yeah.
Of sort of really top class flat jockeys in particular, you know, struggling with alcohol. And so he lives in that context. And to that extent, you know, you can extend some understanding. I just slightly wonder if, you know, maybe his life might be easier if he scaled back his ambition in terms of the numbers of winners he's riding. Mm. You know, if he stops pursuing the champion jockey status, if his life isn't just sort of one hectic chase up and down the motorways all summer, you know, maybe he'd find life easier to deal with. Got to be worth trying, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe keeping himself busy is what he thinks is best for him.
Yeah. But Ashin, very much we're part of the story in 2026. Rachel Blackmore won't, guys. Rachel Blackmore, who did so much to transform the sport and as a role model to young girls and women coming through into racing. She retired this year, John. She's much missed, and she did so after another great Cheltenham Festival. Her ride on Bob Olinger in the Stayers Hurdle was sublime. And Franco De Tori announced this year that he will end his career. He'll do that in South America.
I still don't believe it.
You don't believe it?
No.
What, Rachel or Frankie?
Rachel, I'd believe.
You believe that? Okay.
I don't know with Franco De Tori. I don't know. There could always be another chapter. Who knows? He keeps saying it's the last one. So until...
He seems adamant that it is the last
one. Until I see his saddles and gear on eBay,
yeah.
No. I don't believe it.
It's fun having a top-class jockey who's still older than me kicking around, you know?
Yeah, older than both of us.
Yeah.
And so, definitely older than him.
So, you know, yeah, if he wants to keep on going, then brilliant. He has signed up to work for Kia Jurepchen, though, hasn't he?
Two particularly beige and bland characters, so that's going to be...
It'd just be a walking headline onto that business, which I guess...
A couple of jockey injuries. You were at Ascot anyway. I'm only teasing. I think this might be it. What a way to go out.
And there was an occasion when Richard Dunwoody, long after he'd retired, was it a big race ride emerged, and there was talk about him coming out of retirement. He explored it, but didn't actually do it in the end. I don't imagine Frankie would be doing that. I know you've always been a big fan of Rachel Blackmore.
Sure. Well, we all have.
Exactly. She always had to retire at some point, but I always think it's great when a jockey does that. When they're at the time of their own choosing, still on a high, because she was fantastic at Cheltenham again.
Yeah, she's got out on her own terms, so fair play. I would have enjoyed a few more years. She's sort of at the age now that jump jockeys used to stop, sort of 20 years ago, until people like AP came along and proved that you could just keep on going. We can't all be AP, right? It's really difficult for the sport to replace that kind of star wattage that you get from Rachel and Frankie, as you say.
Yeah.
So that's something to worry about.
And up to now, I would question whether she has had an impact in terms of bringing young, because
you're not seeing it on the racetrack.
The Cheltenham Festival this year, only one other female professional jockey had a ride, and I think that was Isabel Williams riding a horse for her dad.
Okay.
So it wasn't, we're not, but you'd hope that the people coming through are still young kids
sure.
who in 3 or 4 years' time will be taking the baton on from Rachel.
Yeah, I think these things can, they can be a slow burn, you know, if she has influenced a load of kids to sort of think of racing as a potential future for them. There's no reason why it would have to happen right away.
Yeah.
And you also hope that she's opened the eyes of trainers and owners to the possibility that, you know, maybe the next jockey who's right for them could be a woman,
yes.
which I think an awful lot of people in jump racing just naturally assume that's they're going to hire a boy, aren't they?
Yeah.
Not just because they expect that effective jump jockeys are always male, but also I think because they a lot of them don't feel comfortable about asking women to take those physical risks.
Yeah.
But, you know, if equality means anything, it means an equal right to sort of go out there and risk your neck. They've been saying the British Racing School for a long time that their percentage of graduates is mostly women. From the apprentice yeah. riding course, you know, for about 10 years they've
but
been
they
saying.
Don't convert to
but we don't see that feeding through. It would be good to see some evidence of that in future years, because you know it when you have successful women in the saddle as well as men, it definitely adds color to the sport, it adds to the sport's appeal, you know, it makes the sport seem like a welcoming environment for women as well as men.
And again, John, another evidence of that was I was over in Melbourne a couple of months ago. Jamie Mellon became the second female jockey to win the Melbourne Cup, and that was a massive story everywhere over there.
Yeah, and racing's always marketed itself as one of the few sports you can compete at a high level, men and women. You walk into any racing yard in the country, as we do regularly, it's a 50% split. Those are the graduates from the racing school. You walk onto any race course and it isn't. There's a logjam somewhere. There's something stopping that from happening. I don't believe it's willingness on the part of young female riders or work riders who think maybe I could be a professional jockey or an amateur jockey. I think there's something is stopping that happening.
Yeah.
Trainers, owners is the logical guess, but who knows?
But I mean, you mentioned the family thing, you know, girl riding for her dad. But that, to some extent, that's just jump racing, isn't it? You know, I mean, Ruby
yeah.
Walsh got his start
absolutely
from his
yeah.
family, and there's been a load of very successful jockeys, men and women,
yeah.
who've been given those first opportunities by their family. And, you know, maybe that's going to be the source of the next 2, 3, 4 successful women in jump racing, you know, is because they'll have family members who are just good at the game and send them good chances. That's just the way it happens. It's a small little world.
Yeah. As we gallop towards January, we gallop towards the end of this program, but one thing we definitely want to talk about is the extent to which this was a year of turn-ups and also of pacemakers. It was a year in which, as we've documented earlier on, the Triumph Hurdles won by a 100-1 shot, making his debut over hurdles. We had Kirat winning the Sussex Stakes at 150-1 as pacemaker for his much vaunted stable companion, who Field of Gold. How quickly they forget Field of Gold was beaten in the Sussex Stakes. We then had on British Champions Day Powerful Glory winning the champion sprint at 200-1. We had Cicero's Gift win the QE2 at 100-1. A couple of weeks ago, we had a 300-1 British winner, Blowers, becoming the biggest prize winner in Britain ever. We had a 250-1 Irish winner the same week. I backed none of them, did you?
Yeah, oh, but you know, the extra one, just in running, because, you know, it was in front, down the back, and travelling kindly, and people were still writing off. But, I mean, you know, I think of myself as somebody who likes looking for outsiders that might win, and
yeah.
you know, you could give me, I don't know how many goes at the QE2 before I'd land on Cicero's Gift. And it was like that for a lot of the year. I mean, you know, you're not backing Pony Ross, are you? And,
no.
You know, I'm a big fan of Richard Hughes, but I wasn't on
no half
measures in the July Cup at 66-1. Cercini 33-1 in the Coronation Stakes. You know, it was just, it felt a lot of the time as a punter that the ground was shifting beneath your feet. I like that sense that that anything could happen, right? I think that lends itself to enjoyable sport. I need it to be predictable enough that I can see it coming. Maybe next year.
Did you see any of it coming?
No, I'd always get in the car after racing and phone my dad, and he'd obviously have backed all of them.
All of them.
Typically. Yeah. No, didn't see them coming. It makes the job very exciting, but also very stressful when you've sort of got a few ideas about what your introduction might be.
Yeah.
Some of the finest words I've written this year have ended up in the bin.
Oh, they were good, though, to be fair. Yeah, they were very, very good.
Stuff you write ahead of time.
If you've seen them, oh.
Stuff you write ahead of time, you know, trying to think, well, Field of Gold's going to win, and this is the story, and then Kira just doesn't stop.
Well, actually, on the Kira thing as well, Chris, we
referenced pace.
But yeah, so Kira was astonishing. But then, what was it, 2 weeks later, up at York, the Jodmer International, a tremendously anticipated race. Ombudsman was there as the one of the big contenders, and yet his André Farb trained pacemaker, Burr Castle, almost won the race under Rab Havlin. Got an amazing.
I don't know if he almost won it, but he went a long way clear.
It looked like he was going to win for a long way.
So there's some people who sort of communicate with me through the Front Runner newsletter that I do, who are becoming very anti the whole deal with pacemakers, you know, and talking about, is this really a legitimate thing to be doing? Because, number one, you're not always helping yourself in the way that you hope. But number two, you're really messing up some of these high-profile races. We spent all of the Sussex Stakes and most of the Jodmer International wondering if the bunny was going to come back to the field. And these are, you know, some of the most important races of our year.
Yeah.
I think people would like to feel free to just watch the good horses and find out which of them's best. The thing with the Sussex Stakes, I mean, you know, Goodwood on quick ground, those are the ideal conditions for a horse just to keep going in front.
Yeah.
It was a very funny looking race. It's going to be a long time before a race pans out like that again. Right?
I remember Tom Kerr was there that day at York, and he told me how he watched it from down on the rails.
Mm.
And he sensed when it looked as though Burr Castle might well win, that there was almost a sense that people would start booing here if this horse goes and wins. And you referenced Bunny there.
Yeah.
But John, there's definitely a cultural element to this, because over in the States, Mike Rapoli, one of the big owners there, he's had a thing about pacemaker this year, talking about one of the big stables running rabbits in races. In Australia, they would think it was completely ridiculous, this idea of horses having pacemakers. And yet, it's very much ingrained, not just in British racing, but in European racing.
And it's complicated, because if you look at the rules of racing, you talk about horses running on their merits. The idea that a horse can be in a race and isn't actually supposed to win is really odd.
Yeah.
And I think it's just not been as big a topic of conversation, because a lot of the time the right horses come through, won, often by the skin of their teeth, and just about got away with it not being a conversation. You know, Jodmer International, I think we had the right winner and he was always going to win. But there was a moment there where you thought, as you say, here we are again. It's just because we've had so many big price winners, it just kind of gained a lot of legs, didn't it, during the summer. And there was a lot of head scratching, and you had Plato over here and Socrates talking about the whys and wherefores of running on merits and what does that mean? And is this, we've kind of got our own heads about it a little bit. But I do think it's a worthwhile discussion, because particularly in those big races, you'd like them all to set off, run on their merits, best horse wins. The idea that
on a strong, even pace.
Technically, in a sense, you might, a non-sympathetic view is sabotage a race by throwing in a front runner. It's just,
I think what we need to acknowledge is that pacemaking is a hard thing to do right.
Yeah.
I'm pro the idea. You know, I think in top class flat races, you know, if pacemaking done effectively helps the best horses to emerge, but it can go wrong.
And it has gone wrong this year. There were definitely races, I think at Ascot, maybe the Royal Meeting, when pacemakers didn't work.
Quick, absolutely, right, Prince of Wales, I think.
Yeah, that was the one. Yeah, but went completely bad.
And then there was a really weird looking small field King George, where the horse that we sort of expected to go off in front actually was restrained alongside a stablemate in front.
Yeah.
You know, with the result that the Godolphin horse that sat behind never got a run, you know, deeply strange stuff. And just the fact that Ballydoyle are using Continuous as a pacemaker, or what they were.
A former St. Ledger winner.
He's won more than £1 million in prize money, but he's the bunny for some of their other horses. It's been a constant source of discussion this year, and I guess it will be again. Like I say, I'm pro the idea, but you always have to be wary as a punter that this is something going wrong. I do know somebody who backed here at just on the basis that maybe he would
really
get, you know, and it'd be just a few quid, you know, on the basis that at that price, why not? And maybe it'll just keep going in front. It's something that, you know, if you sit down afterwards, you think, well, that was maybe more foreseeable than I realised.
You referenced the Prince of Wales Stakes, which I don't think people largely remember as one of their favourite races of the year. I mean, we all have our own, but there's a reason for it.
I thought it was going to be when Anmart went to the front, but yeah, then he got gunned down, didn't he?
Who won it?
Ombudsman, wasn't
Ombudsman. It? Ombudsman, actually, he was really impressive. Maybe it was a race of the year, because he was really impressive. What for you guys, what would be your race races of the year?
So, I'm quite into older flat horses. Just the idea of, you know, these familiar horses staying in training, the sort of jump racing culture that we used to think of as being a jump racing thing. So, Anmart was one of my favourites this year. Rebel's Romance as well, you know, just such a likeable horse, you know, running all around the world at the age of 7, and some of his best performances this year. So for that reason, I really enjoyed seeing him win at Royal Ascot and the Hardwick. That was one of those races where you could still see that he was being underestimated by people. He's not a sexy horse, and I guess that's part of it. But, you know, he ought to have been a really strong favourite for that, and I was delighted to see him win and get some recognition.
Perfect.
I just wish that Willie hadn't pulled that rabbit out of the hat in America, and he could have won the Breeders' Cup Turf again.
Hell of a rabbit. John, what about you?
I'm going to give you three in three different categories.
Three different categories?
One, Glandegan.
What's the category
stakes.
There?
Flat.
Flat, okay.
European flat.
European. So
best horse in the world.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Probably the best trainer in the world currently on the flat. It's not really a weird hill to die on because he's been winning all these massive races, but I think Graffard's the next sort of Aiden in terms of big runners, big
the
winners.
Next Aiden. There you go. That is a clip big old thing you've
second.
Tied round his neck.
International. Saudi Cup.
I mean, okay.
Romantic Warrior, first run on dirt to get that close to Forever Young, mm-hmm. won the Breeders' Cup Classic, which is about as franked as the form can get. I think that was a very good race. And jumps, I watched the Gold Cup from the stands, which is not where I'd usually watch it, right down at the bottom. And I know the way you're thinking with Galopin de Champs was exceptional and might even play out next year. Look at me throwing it forward.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
That was it. That's the three.
Well, they were very good. They were very good.
Thank you.
And if that's looking back, what about looking forward? Because 2026, what have we got coming this year? We've got a new Friday Night Live series in January, an attempt to bring in a new youthful 18 to 25-year-old audience into racing. That's an ARC initiative in partnership with Invades, ITV, and now the Racing Post as well. We've got on the racing politics front, we'll have this new BHA independent board that hopefully might make things happen over here. The Derby will undergo a revival in June, partly with the help of boxing promoter Frank Warren. Could be a big year, Chris. What are you particularly excited about?
I am, as a the old-time fan of racing generally, mm-hmm. Looking forward to another year of the pattern of racing with which I've grown familiar over 40 years. And what I want our new rulers to understand, people like Lord Allen, is that the most important thing is to preserve this sport in very similar condition to what we've been appreciating over the decades, and try and leave that legacy for future generations to enjoy in much the same way. You know, the same races at the same time of year that have been going on for ages and ages, and just that familiar rolling pattern of the season. There was some chat from Lord Allen, you know, during the summer about innovating and changing things, and, you know, that makes me get a bit uptight and suspicious. You know, we certainly don't want the fabric of the sport to be subjected to any kind of upheaval. The point is to sort of find new revenue streams as ways of supporting what we already have.
It's a sweet spot, isn't it? And it's finding that sweet spot of not burning the ship, but equally bringing new people on board.
Yeah, and I'm sure it can be done. You know, it's a great sport. You and I have loved it for a very long time, and if we do, then other people can too. We just got to find them.
What about you, Mr. Harding?
Much the same. I mean, just a broader point. I've sort of covered the sport now, what, 7-8 years, relatively youthful, I know. Just in that time, a great many problems have been identified. Racing's never had any issues identifying its problems. In fact, it's incredibly good at that. It's the solutions, and I'd love to see some. I think the independent board is a positive step. I think anything that makes the sport more commercial has to be a positive step. That would be my main hope. Just put the customer and the experience first for a change would be nice, because it feels as though racing's still trying to make up ground with other sports. And actually, in terms of the product, in terms of the day out it offers, in terms of the storylines and all the things that keep us captivated all year long, there's so much to sing and dance about. You just have to, as Chris said, take it to people in the right way, package it up and welcome them in.
Yeah, and I'd be saying completely agree. But if racing is to do better commercially, I think racing only ever works well as an industry if it's treated first and foremost as a sport. And you've got to think of it as a sport, and the sport has got to work for it to succeed as an industry.
Yeah, hear, hear.
That then was 2025, all wrapped up in just about an hour. John, Chris, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for watching the front page all through the year. We shall return in 2026, which starts in no time at all. Now, by the time we come back here next week, it will be 2026. Isn't that an exciting thought? Until then, bye-bye.